Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Back in those days, there was no TV coverage, you know. I was in a Chinese restaurant somewhere and somebody came in and said, you got 5 nominations. And it was like a bolt out of the blue, you know.
Hello, and you're very welcome along to this week's episode of the Group Chat Podcast from Virgin Media News. I am political correspondent Gavin Riley, joined as ever in studio by news correspondents Zara King.
Hello.
And Richard Chambers.
Hey.
Richard, are you newly liberated from documentary booth duty? Trump's Last Stand finally made it out Tuesday night.
We got there in the end.
Free man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, great reception to it. Delighted. We got it out there, so yeah.
Still available to watch on the Virgin Media Player if anyone didn't manage to catch it. We have a lot to get into, so let's get straight to it. And because sometimes we have to discuss some fairly difficult or sometimes fairly heavy going topics, and there will be some of that later in this week's episode, let's start with something a little happier. Let's take a look at our first clip.
I don't know, it was like Italia 90 all over again or something. It was just amazing, yeah. You know, a historic day like for Irish film. First time there's ever been an Irish film nominated in this category. First time there's ever been an Irish language film nominated at the Oscars. You know, for me as an Irish speaker, who's like myself and Cleona, who's the producer on the film, like we're married and we're raising our kids in Dublin here through Irish, and it just means the world to us. It's incredible.
Wow, that is so exciting.
Isn't it lovely? Yeah. Colin Barry, the writer and director of On Colleen Q, and celebrating yesterday as his film was nominated for an Academy Award, one of 14 Academy Award nominations for films and performers on this island. One man who knows a little bit about getting nominated for Academy Awards is six-time nominee Jim Sheridan, who's joining us now. Jim, thanks so much for talking to us this week on the group chat. If it doesn't sound too twee or glib a question, did you ever think you'd see the day where there were 14 nominees from the island in any one year?
No, well, I did, but I didn't know how long it would take, you know. I think it's like in 92, Neil Jordan got 6 for Crying Game. And the following year, we got one more for In the Name of the Father. And I think since then, it's been, Room did very well. And one other movie that year, I can't remember. And, you know, this is an amazing achievement. I love both movies, you know, and Mescal's an amazing actor. I was with Colm and his wife in Spain recently, and they were surprised they hadn't seen the movie, but I've seen it since, and it's really good. And I think if it was in English, you'd think Carrie Crowley might have gotten nominated. She's so good, you know, as a little girl. It's a wonderful little movie. Not little, but, you know, it's a wonderful movie. And it's great to see the Banshees doing so well. Like, I mean, McDonough's a genius, you know. And I don't think we give him enough respect in Ireland, you know.
Yeah. I know what you mean, Jim. Obviously, you've been through this process now, and so many people, 14 people or 14 award nominations. You've been there. There's 3 separate Oscars where you've, you know, you've gotten the nod there. Can you just tell us what it's like from that process when you get told that you're nominated for an Academy Award, right through, you're going through, you know, the tuxedo on or whatever you want to wear yourself, Jim, you're going to the Oscars. What are your standout sort of memories from that time? Or did you really, you know, it's probably hard to sort of put yourself back in that place. Did some of it pass you by at the time? Or what do you remember about all that?
No, it doesn't pass you by.
Yeah.
I'm glad. It's very exciting. you know, it's like back in those days, there was no TV coverage, you know. I was in a Chinese restaurant somewhere and somebody came in and said, you got 5 nominations. And it was like a bolt out of the blue, you know. So that was my left foot, you know. And then the next year we got nominated with The Field and then In the Name of the Father. So it was a great run. And you know, I'm delighted all the time to see these other people come along and, you know, do so well. Lenny Abramson and, you know, Element and Ed Gainey, and they're a really good company. And, you know, Martin McDonagh is a rule unto himself, you know. You know, it used to be like this. Every 10 years, an Irish play would play on Broadway. It would be Philadelphia, Here I Come, followed by Da, followed by Dancing at Lunasa. And it was kind of the same in the Oscars. But Martin McDonagh has had about five or six plays on the, you know, Broadway and the West End. So he's just a rule to himself. And if he's lucky and sticks around, he might get an into the Irish Independent top 50 films, Irish films.
And Jim, how does it actually work? You might give us a peek behind the curtain, because I think a lot of people probably don't understand the process. So you're nominated. When someone is nominated now, what's the journey between nomination and actually winning? Like, it's quite an expensive process, isn't it, over the next couple of weeks? A lot of campaigning that goes on. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the studios are only delighted to spend the money from the income of the films to promote them at the Oscars. It's probably the most successful spend, as they call it, in America, because you've got a captive audience, you've got, you know, all the journalists keep jumping on it, and it you know, what you put out, you get 10 times back. But, you know, the whole trade used to survive on the Oscars, and it became, you know, like a political campaign as opposed to an award show, you know. And I think it stayed like that. You know, I think Martin has a good chance, definitely, for screenplay, and Colin has a great chance, but it's going to be, you know, be difficult to beat Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is an Asian feel-good story. But, you know, it's so great to, they got all these nominations. Now let's get a few wins, as they say.
What's Oscar light night like, though, Jim? I mean, we all see the telecast now, or we watch it the day after here on the television. What was your favourite memory from an Oscar night? I mean, who do you get to sit beside? Do you get any choice in who you're sitting beside? Who are you chatting to in the aisles? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's interesting. The first night I was there was Denzel Washington.
Oh, amazing.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he asked me to do, I met him to do a movie. Sitting behind me was Bruce Springsteen and Neil Young the next time.
Wow.
And Neil Young asked me to do a shoot of a concert, which I did, which recently he was looking for the footage of again. It was with Pearl Jam in the RDS.
Yes. It's a networking thing as well then, Jim, is it? Because you depend on who you're sitting near. There's opportunities there to be found.
Yeah, I didn't know what the word networking meant back then.
I'm not too clear either now, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, that has become a buzzword, but they were just two things, you know. I didn't do the thing with Denzel, but I did it with Neil. You meet a lot of people. I mean, you know, like Martin McDonagh is going to be sitting there, but like he's done a few American movies, but like I think the Irish ones are with the ones with an Irish DNA are better, you know?
Yeah.
In Bruges and this one. It's just a thing. It's very hard to go to another culture and replicate it, you know? So I think I found that, even though I did, you know, a few movies that were successful, it's when you know your territory, you're better off, you know?
One last question, Jim, because we're almost out of time. Just, I suppose you've had a better perspective than most people on how Ireland is perceived in Hollywood or, you know, at the Oscars. I mean, you know, for a tiny little country, are we doing quite well globally, do you think, given this result this week?
Well, this is the moment where we pat ourselves on the back. And yes, we're doing way better than you could ever imagine. I mean, you wouldn't have any, I would not even say in L.A. Maybe if you took Hell's Kitchen in New York, you've got Stallone, Timothy Chalamet, you know, my friend who's a writer, Bobby Maresco, and a few others. But like, we've got five times that in Dublin. So, you know, it's so surreal how good the Irish are at storytelling and the arts. It doesn't get supported, you know. And, you know, I don't want to get into it because there's some poor person out there that can't pay their electricity bill. And I'm going to say, you know, Screen Ireland should get many more millions, which they should. So, you know, you can never win on that because people don't have an equation. Same with, I think, RTE. I know you guys in Virgin think, I think the opposite. I think both are, you know, I think RTE should be funded because you need a public broadcaster to stand against these streamers. And I think Screen Ireland should be, and they've got 15 billion, you know, they've got so much money, the Irish government, they should be giving it out.
Food for thought. Jim, we will let you go. Thanks so much for giving us your insights into the state of the industry and getting to rub shoulders with unlikely people at Oscar night. I'm going to be watching all the unlikely seating arrangements now. Jim Sheridan, thanks so much for joining us this week on Group Chat.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Come on, Jim. Bye.
Welcome back to the Group Chat. We wanted to spend a little bit of time this week talking about Ireland's problems with racism. And already I'm conscious that there might be a lot of viewers or listeners who might not think that Ireland, in fact, has much of a problem with racism. I suspect it's probably the case that if you don't think Ireland has a problem with racism, then you've never been on the receiving end of some hostile or unwanted commentary. One of our guests in studio this week has received a lot of that in the last couple of weeks. Author, activist, teacher, presenter, all-round legend, Eimear O'Neill. Eimear, thank you for joining us this week on the Group Chat. You have found yourself in the last couple of weeks at the receiving end of a lot of hostile commentary, at least online, if not in other places too. We start by just asking you to tell us exactly how you've come into harm's way in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, so the commentary has been vile, to say the least. I think it kind of started as a personal attack on me with like certain claims of, you know, you're looking for fame and limelight. You tried your hand at presenting. You were crap. So this is your way, you know, to try and gain some fame. And I just like it's laughable because never have I ever experienced necessarily a positive outcome for standing up to racism and in general in the history of the world. If somebody wants to be famous or to have limelight or advance their career, you generally don't stand up and speak about something that's not really recognized as such, you know, and isn't always the common kind of theme or understanding by many, you know.
Just to bring people up to speed for people who aren't fully familiar with the background details of it, and we don't need to go over it too much because it's all out there in the public anyway. You were at a live show with Tommy Tiernan and he made a joke that you objected to. You raised concern about that joke. You called it out online, which is, of course, you're right. And if you feel aggrieved by something, it is, of course, your entitlement to bring it up. What was the immediate reaction when you did that?
Things like, did you not know what you were going to? You know, you work for RTE and so does he. How did you not know that they're the kind of jokes he tells? You're a snowflake. You're so easily offended, always playing the victim. There was a lot of here she goes again, because I'm an activist. Like, I'm an activist for equality and, you know, especially ethnic minority groups. That's my main focus, always has been. But yeah, just that kind of sensitivity, can't you take a laugh, or this also censored new world, cancel culture or being woke, you know, you can't get away with saying anything anymore. And I suppose my response to that is a hard racism is never comedy. If you as a comedian need to punch down like that, it says a lot more about you, I believe. And there are plenty of comedians out there that are amazing at their craft that don't need to diminish or degrade minority groups to get a laugh, you know. So I appreciated, obviously, that Tommy did reach out to me and apologize. I did try and meet up with him in person, and unfortunately he said he was too busy to do that. Just to kind of reiterate the fact that apologizing to me is not something that I actually ever asked for. And what was probably more important and on the scale of making change and a difference would have been a public statement, because it would have shown him as an advocate for our community and an activist for our community. And it would have expressed and stopped the kind of misinformation that was going around in terms of, you know, he took ownership. Expressed that it was offensive and he should have been called out about it, and it was taken from his set. And furthermore, has been dropped by Free Now, a taxi company, because they also don't stand for hate speech. And, you know, I think, you know, I have to commend them for taking that stand. I in no means wanted this to be an Eimear and Tommy thing. And I think that's what people made it. What it is about racism in Ireland, about the lack of diversity here, the lack of education, and the need for us to move forward because we're decades behind other countries in terms of even just acknowledgement of it. It's like my tweet, I tweeted yesterday and just said, I'm going to explode, I think, if I hear another person say to me that they're shocked when they hear about a story about racism, because how can you be shocked? Like, you have to literally have your head in the sand.
Yeah.
And it means that, you know, you as an individual, you need to open up your world, you know, like, who are your friends, who are in your community? Because if you know even one person from an ethnic minority group, our stories are all the same, because we go through the same issues, you know, on the regular.
And Emer, do you think that comes from a place of unconscious bias where people think, well, if I don't feel it, or my friends don't feel it, or I don't see it, then it's not happening?
Absolutely. And I think unconscious bias is the key word in a lot of this, because I do think that a lot of the time there isn't malice as such behind, but there's a lack of education. And then, you know, when you live in a systematically racist world, you know, we are all unconsciously biased about things. Like, I am unconsciously biased about things. And I feel like if you can't step back and reflect on that, then you're probably doing something wrong. You know, when you look at, in terms of like the European standard of beauty, what's put out in the media, like, all of that kind of stuff, even in itself, gives you an unconscious bias of what is attractive and what is beautiful, right? So, you know, you see a person of African descent, you know, we don't have thin and straight long nose. We don't have, you know, certain size lips. Our body shapes are different. Don't even mention the hair, you know. So I think, you know, until you start seeing those changes within the media and more representation and equality and diversity, that people are seeing it every day, it becomes the norm. And it's not like either tokenistic, or, you know, where you get to a point where it doesn't have to be even like a thought. But the unconscious bias, like, I had a conversation with an old school friend, and she said, oh, you know, I saw what was happening, and, you know, but I like Tommy, and, you know, and I just kind of feel like, is it really racist here though, Emer? Like, and I just kind of said, you know, I can't, yes, it is. And it's really hard for me to continue to answer that question until people start to do the work themselves and the education themselves, and also open up themselves to community. Because I asked her straight out, I said, do you have any friends from an ethnic minority group? And she said, no.
Yeah.
And I said, that's the main reason why you're asking me the question about, is there racism here? Because I can promise you that if you did have friends or relatives, or, you know, in any way were engaged in that community, you would understand and know the severity of the issues that go on daily for so many from ethnic minority groups here in Ireland.
Do you think that there's an element of sensitivity in Ireland about this, that we don't like being, you know, having a mirror held up to ourselves when we talk about things like racism, that Irish people have an immediate defensiveness when you bring up issues of racism?
I do a little bit, yeah. And I find it really hard. It's a hard pill to swallow for me, because we ourselves are immigrants. You know what I mean? Like, when you date back and you think of the slogans, no blacks, no dogs, no Irish, like, at one point in our ancestors' lives, you know, we were looked at as, you know, second-class citizens, as, you know, dangerous, violent alcoholics. There was times where having an Irish name, an Irish accent, you couldn't get a job, you couldn't get housing. You know, you were treated lesser than. You were treated as if you were a black person. Like, literally, that's kind of the whole thing. So it's not like we don't have experience of, you know, understanding what it's like to be discriminated against, and also go to other countries and try and make a life for ourselves there, because we have friends, families, you know, our loved ones that are living all over the world still. It's not like just a past tense thing, you know. We've got people in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Great Britain. We're all over the world as Irish people. And thankfully, we're not really facing that extent, you know, of racism now, but it definitely is something to do with our past. And I think sometimes people say, in terms of racism and black history, you know, I wasn't a slave owner. I wasn't alive 400 years ago. Why is this my problem? And why are we still talking about this? The problem is that, yes, there isn't slavery anymore, but a lot of the oppression and discrimination that stems from back then is still apparent today. Have you ever stood back and actually wondered why, for some reason, you have this unconscious bias that somebody with brown or black skin potentially might be uneducated, you know, be a leech to the system, you know, not have a job, be dangerous in some kind of way. It all dates back to history, you know, because it's been ingrained within the systems of the world that people of color are A, B, C, and D. And unless you as yourself challenge that supposed norm and really educate yourself and learn about history, like, it's very hard for your mind frame to change or for you to be able to step back and realize, oh my goodness, I am unconsciously biased and I'm getting it now. I understand. Yeah. Because when the penny drops for people, like those on their journey to allyship, when that penny drops and when you see it, when you see the lack of representation in terms of ethnic diversity, you will never unsee it again, ever.
Can I ask just one thing on it? Because I think it's interesting what both yourself and Emma Dabbery as well, who, you know, an amazing writer, if anybody's out there, absolutely get on her books. They're sensational. But what both of you experienced, which I noted over the week, was that it wasn't just even the question of, well, here's people with anonymous accounts who are, well, very brave to say whatever they want to say behind anonymous, you know, usernames. But people were actually, with their full name, their full profile image, were slanging racism at you guys. It didn't matter what social network it was on. I just thought that was something which was quite interesting. And I wonder, we talked a little bit about this before we did the podcast, is, do you think that there's an emboldenment there at the moment? And why do you think that is?
Yeah, like, I'm not shocked by that because this isn't the first time this has happened to me. You know, this same kind of thing happened to me and my family about 3 years ago. And when I it was the first time I started speaking out about racism in Ireland. And because I felt, you know, after the death of George Floyd, that a lot of people were pointing fingers at the US. And I was like, guys, like, I'm born and raised here. You don't even, I can't even start to begin to tell you the things that I've been through. What's happening on our doorstep? Like, do not point fingers. Because when you point a finger, you've got three of them pointing right back at you. And like, that kind of self-reflection was needed. But I never had the courage or confidence to speak out about it. But when I did do that, there was a lot of those, that commentary, you know, and it's been quiet for a little while. And then, you know, now, again, I've stood up for something that we should have all, everybody in that room with me, all my fellow Irishmen should have stood up and said, that's not okay. You know, racism is not comedy, period. But they didn't. And there was a lot of laughter. And that was an isolating position. But then to see the rhetoric and commentary afterwards was even harder, I think, to really grasp. But there's strength in numbers. So like, when you see one person write a comment, and you're like, well, okay, they wrote that comment. So, you know, it kind of gives you a bit of strength. And you're like, you know what? Yeah, loose lip. This is how I actually feel. Mm. And I'm going to be that keyboard warrior. And I'm going to just go ahead and say what's really on my mind. And the scary thing is, these people, like, I've seen some people from Bray that I know. Like, I won't say we're friends, but we'd be acquaintances. Mm. And to see some of the stuff that they've written it's so hurtful, you know?
The people who would salute you in the supermarket.
Absolutely, you know? Oh, that's what I'm saying. They're like, they're the people in your baby groups. They're the ones you're going for coffee with. They're your friends. They're your family. They're potentially your loved ones. Like, you know, and you just see it, you know, that ugly head kind of raise when, and social media gives this platform for a lot of incitement for hate and misinformation as well, you know. And it's just, you know, it's a kind of a snowball thing. And I think pointing out that, you know, companies, when they hire you, a lot of places do checks. They do social media checks. They will Google your name. And I think people forget that, you know, potentially either now in the job that you're in, should your employer see that, you know, you're spouting this vile hate, it could potentially affect your job right now. Or it could affect your job in the future, because companies don't want to hire people that are not inclusive and, you know, don't love other cultures and other people. Like, in terms of business and work, everything we do, we're connected to the rest of the world and what we do. The things, the music we listen to, the clothes we wear, you know, in general, like, everything we do has come from cultures from all over the world. And we can't deny that.
Do you, sorry, I think that another point that you make there about the people making those comments is that actually it's not bots or it's not fake accounts. That's the takeaway from that, isn't it? Is that, like, I actually think that maybe there's a perception sometimes that these are bots or they're fake accounts and that it generates it. But like you're saying, there's people behind those profiles who are very real, who are very much, you know, like people that you know. And I think that's just to reiterate that point again. When you talk about being an ally, and I think there might be people who listen to the podcast today who might be having an aha moment about unconscious bias actually, and you know, they may want to learn actually. for you, I suppose, you touched on it already, being an ally begins with understanding and accepting that unconscious bias. What other, you know, kind of key factors are part of being a good ally?
Well, history is huge. So understanding the history of racism is huge. Like, I honestly did not learn about that until I went to America when I was 18, because it's not part of our curriculum. And teachers that do cover that within the Irish curriculum, it's by choice. So like that's huge. Understanding the history of slavery, the history of where the N-word derives from and what it really means, and people so loosely use it. And then like our own history of being immigrants ourselves and the racism that we were persecuted through too. But I have a TED talk and I talk a lot about unconscious bias. So I talk about things that might trigger, you know, thoughts for other people, like, I've done that, you know, or, you know, oh my goodness, I've seen that happen. And I've never, I didn't say anything, you know, but going forward, you know, I'm going to speak up. Olympic Ireland, Sports Ireland did a delete, ban and report, don't scroll by campaign that I was a part of. And it's like the simplest thing, simplest concept, but to actually do it really does make a change, you know, that you're reporting these comments, you're blocking these people, you're banning, and also that you're reaching out to the victims. Because honestly, for me, throughout the course of the last 3 years on my activist journey, if it wasn't for people reaching out to me, I wouldn't know that generally the majority of people really do support change and equality and are not racist and do get it and are working on their way towards allyship. But that communication with people is so important. Like, I'll get a message that'll say, look, I don't usually do this. Like, just reach out to someone I don't even know, but I just wanted to say to you, like, fair play. And I'm really sorry that you're going through that. I'm actually ashamed of my Irish, fellow Irishman. Like, I just can't even believe it, you know? And a comment like that, and stay strong, you know, and be the voice for people that can't have that voice or don't know how to use their voice. A message like that for me negates like 100, you know, negative comments.
Because it can be easy for people just to almost try and ignore it.
Yes.
It can be uncomfortable for somebody to come to you and say that, but they need to put that, you know, discomfort to aside, because there's doing the right thing is kind of the important
thing,
isn't
it? And it's like that discomfort of having those conversations. Yeah. Like, and I've chat, like, I do anti-racism workshops. I do them in schools and I do them in organizations, and more so in a lot of organizations as of late. Before it was just schools, and now I'm seeing companies like really like investing in it, you know? And it just kind of goes to show that, you know, people do want to make change. They want to know how to make change. And I'm one of those people that I don't mind talking about it. And I like to talk about it. I learn as much as somebody else does. I don't have all the answers. I think we need to learn together and we need to figure it out together as a country. But also there are people from ethnic minority groups that have been through so much trauma that they don't have the capacity to talk about these things, you know, and it is a lot of pressure on a person to have to educate people when all of the resources are out there for you, the podcasts, the books, the documentaries, you know, and it's like simple things like start in your own home. Just look around your home. So what kind of books do you have? Are the authors people of color? You know, how cultured is your own home and your own even movie selections, right? Like Netflix has a section where it's literally like protagonists are all people of color, you know, so you can go in and see somebody in a leadership role or, you know, being the main person. And because a lot of times that's not the case. So you have to do the work to go out and see that. And then the way you change your life within your home, if you have children, you know, they see that too. Like it's an actual effort, you know, you want to make sure that their toys are diverse and not just because I feel like when you're from one minority group, you are from them all, right? There's this intersectionality that people somehow forget about or can't quite connect them. But like, let's say, you know, you're a feminist. What about black and brown women? Yeah, well, I mean, that's, you know, as a white woman, that's not really me, like anything to do with me though. But as a feminist, we are both women. take that other factor away. We're both women, you know, and you, so no matter so what race you are, how you identify, you know, your sexual orientation, your class, your gender, your religion, like somebody falls into at least one of those character, into those communities, if not you, somebody that you know, a family member. And our lived experiences of trauma are so similar, you know? So I believe that if you want to try and understand racism and how to help, think of ways that you have in the past for other minority groups and do the same thing. Like there's no reinvention of the wheel, you know?
Well, it's a journey that, that everyone, I think, has to go on at some point, and whether people are at different stages of it, it's a journey that everyone does go through. And hopefully, as Zara said, this is a conversation that has maybe triggered some aha moments for people who are tuning in today. Your TEDx talk is available still to watch online, so that might be a good starting place if people want to get into it. Thanks so much for coming in to talk to us today, Emer O'Neill.
Thanks for joining us. And you can find that TED talk is on my Instagram, so Emer O'Neill 14. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/newsadfree. That's Amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So Emer O'Neill joining us this week on the group chat to talk about her experiences of racism in Ireland. I think after a discussion like that, it is going to be very difficult to ever say again that you are shocked or surprised by the tone of hostility that some people face in this country.
Absolutely. And I think one of the main takeaways from the conversation with Emer actually was that she really thinks it's important when people reach out as allies and send messages to say, look, I'm sorry you're going through a tough time and here's a message of support. And that's something that maybe we don't think about and talk about actually often enough, because when, you know, she's in that situation and she's being bombarded by so many vicious, abusive messages and comments, you know, to hear even one person come out of the darkness of that and say, like, I hope you're doing all right and I'm solidarity with you is actually hugely important. And, you know, probably something that's not said enough, and that, you know, she really values those kind of comments, that that is part of standing up and being an ally and standing beside someone. But like, I think today's conversation with Emer will potentially have been an aha moment for a lot of people. And I think that that's can only be positive. And I think it's, you know, we said it to her when she was coming in, when she was leaving today, like it's so unfortunate that Emer has to be in the situation that she even has to come in today and meet us under those circumstances. Because actually we've all kind of come across Emer on social media for various different things over the last couple of years, but this was our first chance to meet in person, and it's just really unfortunate that it was under these particular circumstances.
It's something just like what Zara was saying, like we were talking to Emer when it was over, and it's kind of like there is a question around media around this as well, is that so often when we talk about issues around this, that we often ask victims of things to come in and sort of go back over what happened to you, and really that's probably not what we should expect of people who've gone through things. That if we're going to address racism, we kind of just need to have a look at ourselves. We have to look at, you know, all of our own conduct, all of our own unconscious bias, as we said there. And yeah, I mean, Emer, we were chatting during the week as well about this, and she says that she had some thoughts around why she thinks it's particularly prevalent now, or why she feels that people are more emboldened now, that people are sticking their names to things again, which they previously would have hidden behind things on. A lot of it is down to, as she sort of says, she says that there is a lot of it which is to do with what we've seen outside refugee centres over the last while as well, that people are seeing almost a public acceptance and a way that they feel there's a, you know, there's a solidarity. You feel emboldened if you see people beside you who are happy to have their faces and say horrendous things and to, you know, throw abuse at people. And that's something which is worth thinking about as well.
It's a big problem in that light, because so much of that on the face of it is motivated against, well, Ireland should be for the Irish and we should prioritise and look after our own. And it's very blind to the true reality that many of those people are our own. Emer's born here. She's from Bray. She's not from anywhere else. She is as Irish as anybody else. And like she said, when we were packing up and leaving the studio as well, we don't want to talk too much about what we were talking after the mics went, but she was talking about this idea of having to constantly reinforce or defend her Irishness, or trying to, like, you know, this idea that her legitimacy as an Irish person is questioned.
Yeah, and that shouldn't even matter. Like, it shouldn't matter whether you were born and raised here, whether you're treated with dignity and respect. Like, it just shouldn't matter. You know, the bottom line is, like, is that to say then, are we saying that, you know, nobody can live in any land that they weren't born in? Like, it's a ridiculous assertion, like, you know what I mean? To suggest that anyone of any colour or creed can't live in a place that they weren't born. So I think, like, the point you make, Richard, is really valid in that, like, you know, it's unfortunate that we have to ask people to come in after they've had a traumatic experience and relay that and have that be some kind of, like, lessons will be learned moment. But, like, what's the alternative? Do we not have that conversation then? You know, it's so important.
No, you do, but you just have to challenge people. You have to challenge people the fact that, you know, why do we ask the people who are the victims of things nonstop to have to do it? Yeah. Whereas we don't challenge people about, well, why do you have that view? What's happened in your life that you think that that's okay to say and put your name to?
Well, I suppose the something of an answer to that is that we're three white people sitting in a room and we couldn't talk about the problem without talking about someone who's been at the receiving end of it, because no matter how much empathy you might think you have or how supportive you want to be of marginalized groups, that in truth, people like us are probably never going to know what it's like to be in the receiving end of racism. So we're going to have to hear from those who have been. And it's tricky and it's awful that it means asking people to re-traumatize themselves all the time, but it might be the only way that you can really
understand. I'm going to say, like, there are people now and people who have gone through this multiple times and they keep on saying, well, why do the media keep making us do this? So I'm just saying what people are saying as well. So it is one to ponder anyway. It is a difficult one, but as you say, you know, the conversation needs to happen in some way. So there's no perfect way of doing it.
No, there's not. Really appreciate Emer coming in to tell us her story. Her TEDx talk is really worth checking out. And hopefully this was a bit of an aha moment for some people who might not have ever thought about it before. One other story which has dominated a lot of airtime, certainly dominated a lot of my mind this week, whether people think it's warranted or not, is the ongoing controversy surrounding Pascal Donoghue and his posters, and whether it was appropriate for him to accept help putting up posters, whether in fact it is permissible for him to accept that help, and whether it actually warrants a lot of the coverage that there's been. First of all, let's play a little clip of Pascal Donoghue acknowledging some wrongdoing in the Dáil on Tuesday evening.
I am now aware that an unauthorised corporate donation of €434.20 was unknowingly received by Fine Gael Dublin Central. This was in the form of the use of vehicles, the commercial value of which exceeded the maximum allowable donation limit of €200. SIPO have been notified of this breach, and €234.20, the amount received in excess of the allowable limit, will be refunded to the designer group.
It feels like everybody and his neighbour and his pet dog has had their spake on Pascal Donoghue at this point. But for people, how can you boil it down as simply as possible? What is exactly the situation here? Why were people up in arms about it? But also, why were people willing to give him the clean bill of health before every single question had been answered and before full details had actually been released?
Let's deal with that last question first then. It's because Pascal Donoghue is likeable. And I think a lot of people thought that because it's a likeable fella who never has had any sense of impropriety before now, if somebody gave him a bit of help putting up posters, sure, what's the big deal, is their attitude. There are three reasons why it warrants a lot of coverage, and I'll try and be sort of fairly brief with them because this could be as long as your arm otherwise. The first one that I'll do is, that I'll address, is this question of patronage. And this is, I'm going to talk with that first because I think it's the easiest one to put away. There has been an inference that Michael Stone, the guy who helped Pascal Donoghue put up with his posters in two campaigns, had some material benefit from that he was appointed to a directorship of the Land Development Agency, a big state builder, that he was appointed the chair of a state task force on regenerating the northeast inner city and dealing with some social problems there. He was appointed to those roles, and it may well have been linked to his status as a Fine Gael donor. He may have been on Pascal Donoghue's radar to be recommended for those because he's a Fine Gael donor. But there is no inference that he ever materially benefited. Certainly he had, you know, maybe the esteem of those roles. It meant that he had a lot of face time with Pascal Donoghue as minister, with successive Taoiseach in his role overseeing this state body for the northeast inner city. No one can pin anything to suggest that he has materially benefited from that. And anyone who has had any interactions with Michael Stone says he's a fairly civic-minded guy. So he's doing all of this genuinely for the benefit of the area. So that's one aspect. The second is political donations. And Ireland in the past had a huge problem with political donations of people in public office accepting inappropriate payments from people who wanted something out of them.
Yes.
Often to do with rezoning of land and bribery of councillors and TDs and huge, huge money going around. And the reason why we have limits now on political donations is precisely to try and take that out of politics. Now, our limits now for political donations are quite small. A company can only donate €200 to a person or a party. An individual politician can only accept £1,000 a year from any one donor. Mm-hmm. A party can only accept £2,500 mm-hmm. from any one donor. And those are small limits, and they might seem like sure, small infractions of that are no big deal. But the limits are there for a reason. The limits are to stop people with money buying political influence. And in this instance, at the very least, we have had, whether it's inadvertent or not, and people will have their own minds as to whether this was a whole deliberate concoction. But we've had Pascal Donoghue and the Fine Gael branch in Dublin Central accepting corporate donations beyond what is permissible. That was the big aha moment from Pascal Donoghue's appearance on Tuesday of this week. Even if it was only the lending of a van to put up posters, you can't just lend corporate services, or you can't lend the use of a product or an entity like a van or anything else without having to disclose that as a donation. And the donations limits are there for a reason. And that was a donation far more than the 200, which is allowed, which is why Pascal Donoghue now embarrassingly has to hand it back. And that brings us to the third aspect, which is Pascal Donoghue, for a lot of the time that we're talking about for these donations, is the minister responsible for ensuring a robust and up to scratch ethics law. And Pascal Donoghue now admits that he became aware in 2017 that a van was lent to his campaign in 2016. That's campaign spending, has to be disclosed, and he didn't do so. And Pascal Donoghue admits himself, yeah, he should have gone back and corrected the record on that. But he is the minister responsible for the ethics system and is now, whether it's unknowing or not, has breached the ethics system twice. He's the minister for finance who didn't know how his campaign was being financed. He's a cabinet minister who was unaware of 2 four-figure donations to his party. And it might be small in the whole grand scheme of things. It might be small potatoes compared to some of the other scandals that we've had in this country in the past and other scandals elsewhere in the world. But if you think that the rules are there for a reason, then surely the rules have to be abided by, and not least by the guy who is responsible for making sure the rules are there.
And I think maybe it's the point you make about not knowing how it was financed. There's a lot of people in this country who know exactly where all their money is going at all times because they're struggling to pay their bills and they're struggling to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. That the concept that somebody wouldn't know how something was paid for is kind of alien to those people.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like it's the not knowing kind of is what people
also
find kind of.
Yeah,
that's quite a privileged thing to not know how something is being paid for.
And it's alien to a lot of politicians too, because they will tell you that posters are a very central part of their whole election spending. There are very serious caps on how much you can spend in elections, again, to stop you buying influence or buying your way into positions of power. And posters are a very expensive part of most people's campaigns. Mm. So most people would say, they would certainly contend, you would know exactly how many posters have been up and you know exactly how many people did it. So a lot of politicians found the contention that he didn't know who was putting up his posters or that they were paid to do so a little far-fetched, but it's up to individuals to decide whether the story is tenable or not.
Is he safe now? I know a lot of the press and a lot of commentators for the last 2 weeks have been saying he's safe. He's answered all the questions and it's done now and we have to put this to bed and he's a statesman and he works for the Euro Group and it's great and all that sort of stuff. So he was exonerated before the full thing came out, but is he actually going to be in the clear now?
Well, that's up to Sipo. Politically speaking, he probably is out of the woods, so to speak, because when he had his big Dáil Q&A session on Tuesday evening, the Star Chamber, as it's called sometimes, he did the very rare thing, which
like
is, although his story is maybe a little improbable or implausible, he did stick to it and he did manage to get out the other side of that Dáil grilling without raising too many fresh questions. And that really is the acid test, because sometimes politicians have gone into those sessions and they've ended up raising more questions than they've answered. Mm. And then that's when the story becomes so big that the only way to stifle it is by somebody resigning. Mm. Pascal Donoghue, I think, managed not to do that on Tuesday night. So he'll probably be able to hang around for as long as Sipo is investigating this, and who knows how long that will take. It is Sipo, by the way, not Sipo, despite what people might think, having heard that clip. I could rabbit on about Pascal Donoghue for more hours and hours and hours, but really do need to wrap up. Richard's documentary, Trump's Last Stand, still available on the Virgin Media Player or anywhere you get your television, and well worth a look. Do check it out on the Virgin Media Player. Until next time, Richard Chambers, thank you.
Thank you, Gav.
Sarah King, thank you.
Thank you, Gav.
Thanks to all of our contributors. Thanks to Ross, Maxine, Gareth, and everyone in the production gallery. Thank you for watching or listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.